Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Got a great episode, although I'll say that every one of them is great. I mean, maybe they're not, but I guess it depends who the listener is. And then I guess it depends upon whether all three of us are here. Just, I'm sure when Wade and Matt, you guys are here, it's a great episode. When I'm not here, it's phenomenal, I guess, I suppose. But anyway, I have my, of course, my two partners in crime. We got the full roundtable here. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and a director on our SIU investigative and auditing team. And of course, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG Northeast UPIC director and the senior director of payment integrity here. So, so what we're going to talk about is we've talked about mentoring a lot on prior roundtables. All of us have done mentoring. I always say it was one of my favorite things to do as an agent. I love mentoring. I was very proud of being a mentor, and I was even more proud of the people that I mentored because many of them are in very senior leadership positions at the Office of Investigations now. And it really was an amazing thing to see those people grow in their careers. And I know, you know, Wade and Matt, you've done mentoring and supervised people and training and, when, for example, you know, Wade, when a new firearms instructor would come in and you were the senior firearms guy, it's kind of making sure that they learn the ropes, and mentoring never ends as the years go on, and it just takes different courses. So we've talked a lot about mentoring, and so the collaborative piece of mentoring is that interaction, but it's also bringing in the people, and how do you get that collaborative effort to bring those people in that you're going to mentor? And it really starts with, in some cases, bringing in people to be interns, college kids to be interns, or recent college grads that are looking to understand what a career outside of a law enforcement job might be. And so interns can become a great feeder source for your organization's ability to bring the next generation of investigators into the fold. I think that there's oftentimes the challenges that we find are that we get a lot of people that apply to positions that are really well qualified for the job that they had, but they don't really have a skill set that transfers over, but think that their skill set from 20 or 30 years is something that then allows them to command large salaries. I know we see it with fellow law enforcement officers that retire. They may have been a homicide investigator for 20 plus years, and they're at the tip of the spear in those kind of law enforcement investigations, but they don't know anything about spreadsheets. They don't understand. They don't know what a CPT or a HCPCS code is. And so they may have great skills in some areas and maybe not such great skills in other areas. And so sometimes you want to pass on those people because the salary that they are not willing to go below is not a salary that you're willing to pay, because you have to match that skill set to the role. And so sometimes you wind up looking at other ways to try to make that work. And interns can be a great way to make that work. I was the intern coordinator when I was at OIG, and we got a bunch of feeder interns came in from Rutgers University. There are two campuses at Rutgers. One campus has the School of Criminal Justice, and the other one has the Department of Criminal Justice. They're different for whatever reason. Newark has the School of Criminal Justice, Rutgers Newark, and the Department of Criminal Justice is at the Rutgers main campus. And so we would get interns every semester from Rutgers, and it was a great way to educate, and for individuals, kids that were getting a degree in criminal justice who didn't have a desire to have a badge and gun, to learn a little bit about what other careers with a criminal justice degree can get you, because sometimes that's the challenge. And so, Wade, you know, we're bringing on younger people now. We're bringing in, and Matt will talk about this in a minute, what we call the greener people. But, you know, similar to mentoring, you've got to be able to find that right fit for the person. And it's not always the most senior person. And it's really got to be who are your best agents, but it's also who are your best agents who have the tolerance to want to mentor. You know, I would always say, I have no patience for anything. Like, I mean, I have zero patience for anything. I have no tolerance for everything. So much so that I had to have, in Chinese characters, I have the word patience tattooed on my wrist to remind me when I'm in a deposition or a trial to be patient with things, because this is the only place I have patience.
Did you tell the tattoo guy to hurry up?
I did. Yeah, I did. And mostly it was so that it wasn't that I wasn't ordering up chicken fried rice. But you know, the thing that I always found interesting about in being introspective of myself was, as little as I have patience for just about everything or tolerance for most nothing, I always had a lot of patience, a lot of tolerance, and was always willing to answer a lot of questions of both mentees and the interns, because I really did think that that was the important piece. So Wade, the making those connections, having someone within that SIU who becomes your internship coordinator, finding the schools to go to, like these feeders can really work to an organization's benefit because they don't bring baggage.
Right. Yeah, and I was took a similar route. I got into this job, my career as an intern. I was an intern like the second to last semester when I was in college. And I looked at it as though it was like a 6 month or 8 month, whatever it was, like almost like a long-term job interview where the mentor gets to observe, the intern and determine, do they have the skills, the work ethic, that, are they inquisitive? Are they catching on quickly? They can observe their interpersonal skills and communication skills, all that kind of stuff. And at the same time, the intern is learning, is this a job that I want to do? A lot of times we get people that would show up, with their tactical gear on, and they want to kick in doors and stuff. And it's like, well, we do a little bit of that, but if that's really your focus, this probably isn't for you. So the internship, gives them an opportunity to see if it's a good fit for them. Are they going to get bored with looking at spreadsheets? Because there's a lot of that type of work. So it's kind of a two-way street where you get to observe the intern, and the intern gets to kind of see what the job is about. But it's also very important, like you said, that you don't want to just put the intern with anybody. We don't want to have them doing busy work, doing, if you have them with the wrong investigator or agent, they're doing all their dirty work. They're doing their photocopying and, those type of jobs that don't really help them see what the job is about. And we made it a point to not do that. And I would get feedback. I would go to the university as well and talk to the chair of the criminal justice department. I would meet with the intern, the first day of class when they're trying to determine where they're going to go look for an intern and give them a little spiel on what we offer. I get feedback, at the end of the year that we gave them good quality, internships that they were able to learn stuff from. So it's you're right. You do have to have the right person, because if you're going to look at it like a kind of a long-term issue, you have to give them the right type of internship. We typically had one or two interns in the Los Angeles region at all times. Not necessarily all the time, but generally we had that. And we would look at them and, make a determination. We hired a lot of people on as agents as a result of their internship. When I started, I think we had like five agents in Los Angeles, and when I left, we had I think 35, and probably half of those that were still there when I left, who brought on as interns, they ended up to be long-term employees, unlike a lot of the people we would get from different agencies that were kind of jumping from job to job. They couldn't find their fit, so they would be there for a year or two. The interns, and it's kind of a generalization, but the interns tended to stay, if not with our office, at least with the agency for, the better part of their career, if not their whole career. So given that good base of an internship where you get to observe them and they get to see what the job is about, I think is really important for long-term, carryover and making them into an employee.
And so one quick follow-up, but what are some of the characteristics? So you're looking to bring someone in this SIU space, which is a little bit different, and the challenge is we're all working remotely. So that face-to-face office setting becomes a little bit of a challenge. But in the SIU space, what are some of the characteristics? For example, if we've got somebody that's watching this podcast, as everybody should be, but as so globally, while people are watching this podcast or listening to this, And they're thinking about how they can bring some interns in, which become really good, either free labor or low cost labor, depending upon whether they're going to get credits at college or if you're going to pay them some minimum wage or something like that. You can't give an intern an amount of work that's either so complicated that you might as well just do it, or it takes you so long to explain. And that becomes, I think, unfortunately, in our space, that becomes the biggest challenge. Where do you draw that line? But what are some of the characteristics if someone is looking to find an internship in their organization for their kid, the neighbor, through the college? What are a couple of the key characteristics that an intern should have before you bring them on board as an intern?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is they have to have some, they don't have to be a computer expert, but they have to have a little familiarity with, a spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheets. They have to be able to work with Word documents. I think most people these days have at least some degree of that. So that's important because if they've never looked at a spreadsheet before, there's going to be a lot of learning curve there. I think the other very important part now that most, if not all, of the work is, especially for an SIU, is remote. They have to be like a self-starter. They have to be able to work unsupervised. If they require someone to look over their shoulder and give them tasks and check, do this task and now do this task, they have to be able to really look at the bigger picture and, keep themselves busy, give themselves tasks, be able to look at the, with some assistance from the mentor, but look at the investigative process and be able to figure, okay, what I should do next is this, and I'm not going to wait
Right.
for my mentor to tell me what to do. So it's kind of an initiative-based situation, I think is very important.
Yeah. I know when we would interview interns, one of the questions I would ask them would be, how early do you start to work on a paper? Because you're going to get two answers. One answer is going to be, well, I know it's due on Friday. I'm going to start it on the Wednesday, or I know it's due on Friday. I'm starting it 3 weeks from now. So that to me was always a telling sign about how that person worked. The other, and oddly enough, we have unfortunately gotten to a place where everybody presumes that people know basic computer skills, Microsoft Office. We had somebody who was an auditor here for a while. And we learned within about a couple of weeks that this person did not know how to use Excel. It wasn't something that was asked in the interview because I didn't think that I needed to ask that question. Do you know how to use Excel? You've been an auditor for X number of years. And I realized I didn't think I needed to ask that obvious of a question, but sometimes you have to ask some obvious questions. The other question that I always love to ask the interns, because these are all college kids, and so you have to get an idea. And I would say, what is an average day during the week look like to you? And the one gal that we had as an intern who was one of the best interns we had, and then went on to work at an SIU for many, many years, she lived in a house with three other girls. They were all academics. Their boyfriends were all academics. And she said, this is going to sound terrible, but I get up at 5 a.m. every day to get my schoolwork done, go to the gym, and by 9 o'clock, I'm in bed sleeping for the next day. And she said, that is my schedule Monday through Thursday without fail. And I said, okay, what about Friday nights and Saturday nights and Sundays? And she said, well, we go out until 11 or 12. And I thought, okay, everybody's college experience is a little different. But the thing that sold me on her was she took her school responsibilities very, very seriously, but she also took a managing her schedule, but also managing her day-to-day workload seriously. And I will tell you, there were many days when she was the first person in the office. And that was amazing. There was, sometimes we had some people that would show up at 7 or 7:30 in the morning, and there were times when she was already there for an hour. I'd show up to the office sometimes at 7 in the morning, and I could smell the coffee as I was opening up the door, and she had already been there for sometimes a half an hour or an hour. And when her internship was over, she was working on a case and she said, "Can I stay? I know I won't get credits, but can I stay to finish this case out and, complete my resume?" And she was an amazing intern, but there were some of those questions that I asked just resonated with me. Like when I and I'll never forget when I asked her, like, what is her typical school day look like, Monday through Thursday, being understanding that it's the weekend and you're a college kid. I mean, everybody goes out and has a good time, but when she said that, it was like, wow, that's she had a really she was a very, very focused person, which was amazing to me. And so Matt, the other piece of it is that sometimes we bring people over maybe as a junior investigator, or we give them they have a full-time job here. For example, some of our CPCs and our auditor team, some of them have made the leap to investigator or people that started off as CPCs, and we bring them in and give them an opportunity as either a junior investigator, or I know we've had a couple where they came in and they did their regular job as an auditor and then they interned, as an investigator. And I know you've really had a shift in your mindset on hiring to bring in people that help create that mix. Not everybody can be a 20-year veteran. First of all, budget-wise, right? I mean, we should address that. Budgets don't always support the ability to have a bunch of people that are 20-plus year veterans, but you also can't have people that have no experience. But you've actually, I mean, this is why it's a great part of the conversation is you've had amazing success with bringing in people in that mix, but also bringing in some of these newer people. So talk a little about one, that success, but also the fact that when someone comes in with the skill set of being a CPC or a CPMA, for example, which is where, it's a natural transition for a lot of people, some of the challenges in that mental shift that has to occur.
Sure. First of all, I have to agree with Wade. There are some just foundational characteristics you look for in any employee in an investigative role, curious mind, the attention to detail, all of those things. We look for those in any candidate, experienced or otherwise. We tend to find it more with the younger set, whether they're interns or bringing people on that are just starting their careers. Recently, we've brought in people that were just starting their careers as auditors, but they wanted to try something different because, or perhaps they were clinical and they wanted to come in and try something new. We brought them in as interns, even though they had already started their professional careers. They were willing to come in as an intern, that low risk test drive, as Wade talked about. And some of the things we've seen in our current staff that we were thinking, hey, would you want to switch roles? Would you want to do this? Is even as a CPC, they were looking at the cases differently than a regular CPC, where they were going beyond this code, this thing. They were going out, they were doing the social media searches, they had that, I want to solve this puzzle, and they were going beyond what a CPC normally would to try to investigate it. So we were like, let's make these folks auditors. Let's figure out the best role for them and put them in that. And we've transitioned three or four people from CPC roles to investigator roles, all of them very successfully. And the mindset change is getting beyond, this is the code, this is the medical record, these are the determinations, but looking beyond, what is the fact pattern behind that? What's going, getting inside the head of the provider? Why would they code it this way? What is their intent? And trying to figure out, find the information that provides evidence to that. And we've been really successful in mentoring these folks, because one of the things we do with new employees and these transitioned employees and the interns is we have them work with people at every stage along the way of an investigation, from how do you develop a lead? What do you look at when you get a complaint in, or you're looking at data? What are you looking for there? To, if they're an investigator working with an auditor on what the CPC does and how to do the coding and what they look for, interviewing on sites potentially, every step along the way, writing reports, doing all of those things, and then finally putting all of it together in a referral package. So by the time an intern leaves, or by the time a person is trained for our roles. They've done everything for all those roles. And then we work with them on, you know, what fits best here. Do you want to stay as a CPC? Do you want to move into the investigator role? And it's been working really, really well. We've brought in half a dozen interns in the past couple years. Except for one, all of them have transitioned successfully to an investigator role. And as I said, three or four more of the CPCs that we've brought in, either, you know, from off the street or they're already working for us, to transition to investigator roles, all of them very successful. And, you know, it takes time, it takes patience, it takes mentoring. And we've got a great group of investigators and managers here that understand that that's their role, is to, you know, not only do their function, but to make it so these other people can be successful, because we all have the same mission.
And have you found, so, you know, one of the things that we really always stress to all of our external SIU clients that we do training, education, process improvement, and just discussions with, we basically tell them the fox shouldn't watch the hen house. If you have investigators who are CPCs, CPMAs, they should not be doing their own reviews to rely upon for that final overpayment. You need to have an auditor come in with an objective understanding. We always talk about bias confirmation, and that investigators already have a bias because they've opened up a case, they're doing this work. And it's okay for an investigator who has a CPC. We know a lot of plans require investigators to take the CPC course, to be certified, go through that process. But that doesn't, all that should do is provide an investigator with a stronger foundation to be an investigator. It's a little bit like you go out and you get the AFI, you get your CFE, you do money laundering, you know, AML, anti-money laundering certifications that you should really have when practical, you should bifurcate out those roles. And I think one of the challenges that I think we've seen is when auditors are making that transition to investigator, they're, you know, it's their default, right? And getting them to really understand, like, it's okay for you to do these reviews, but you should not rely upon that review. That's why we have auditors. And I think, you know, part of that is explaining there's an opportunity cost, right? Because as an investigator, if you're spending time reviewing those records, you're not spending your time getting your investigations done. And so I think that sometimes becomes the challenge. So as we kind of wrap up, Matt, get like some of your thoughts on that, because that I think we find that with a lot of our plans, particularly smaller plans that don't have a huge budget, they have CPCs that have converted over to investigators, and they're kind of wearing, what hat am I wearing today? Am I wearing the investigator SIU hat? Am I wearing the CPC hat? And so you've got to be able to get somebody to understand what their focus is at that moment.
Yeah, that's really important. We just did an evaluation of one of those small plans where they have, their resources were just that. They were investigators, but they did every aspect of the investigation, including the reviews. And we found that, A, they didn't have the time to do it the right way because they were so multifunctioning, multitasking. In other words, they did bring a bias to the review, that they knew the background facts. They knew what they had found and had their opinions of that, and they brought those to the review. So it's very important to bifurcate that. And I think a pretty favorable thing for advisors, we offered internally some CPC courses, and the investigators were all clamoring to do it because they understood the importance of having both bases of knowledge, but then again, when to apply that. You know, they knew that they weren't going to be doing their own reviews, but they wanted to understand when they got a review, you know, a completed review, they wanted to understand how this came to be.
And that's, you know, we're working super hard to try to make that train. We've done it in the past, and we're working on putting that together. We had an overwhelming, I was actually very surprised at the overwhelming number of people that expressed an interest in the course. You know, and our plan is to do the course not with any intent for people to have to take the CPC exam or anything like that, but more for educational purposes. Yeah. But I think, you know, I think investigators and auditors, we're the same in one sense, and that's we're curious. we have a thirst for knowledge and a thirst for learning things. And so when given these opportunities, you want to jump on them. And I think one of the biggest challenges as an investigator is when you know certain codes and you're very good at knowing those codes and you're very good at understanding them, it's fighting that fight to let somebody else do that review. Yeah. That's sometimes the challenge is, you know, of letting go of that. Because now, you know, with technology at your fingertips, you could spend so much time doing the research to do things and look things up. And as an investigator, you're just constantly hungry for that information. So, but great, you know, great feeder sources, right? Your CPCs who are working for you, who have an interest, they understand the SIU work, interns from the local college, all of that. And while I don't think anybody is saying that an SIU needs to give more collateral duties to an already burdened SIU, you have to think about succession planning. And whether that succession planning is at the lowest level investigator or the replacement for, well, we can't replace Wade or Matt, certainly not Matt. You've got to think in terms of succession planning is who is that next person going to be? Who are the next investigators going to be? Who are the next managers? Who are the next, you know, the next leader? I mean, you guys, I always give hats off to people who chose to go into management. And because sometimes you just, that's where your head is. And that's where you feel that you're going to have the best option for success and driving these. I never once, other than acting as a supervisor for my team, I never put in for a supervisory position. And I've had people who would ask me, you know, why, and I would always say, well, someone here has to do the work. And I always felt like my institutional knowledge for the organization was best served with me being an agent. I still have a very difficult time here at Advise, where I do a lot of operational stuff, a lot of the senior leadership. And I have oftentimes a very difficult time doing that because I just want to get the work done. And so, but that succession planning starts from the beginning, and having the next cadre of people is where that's going to be. And when they start off with the right organization and the right internship and the right training, they become successful. And hopefully, you know, hopefully people will look back and remember that they, you know, where they got their start and who was formidable in that, and, you know, that you got them on a path. So don't ignore these, like, you know, college interns. I think in the technology space where we're working remotely presents challenges for some of that, but, you know, that's what Teams and Zoom and screen sharing and things like that and phones are for. And, you know, you can make it happen. So, good conversation, guys. As always, I appreciate you spending the time. And as always, I appreciate everybody spending their time to join us on our weekly podcast. Again, Spotify and YouTube are the ways to get it, as well as getting it off of our newsletter every Friday delivered to your inbox and LinkedIn. So until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.